From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. The average age of a California farmer is heading for 60. That trend is clearly not sustainable. It's a particular problem for this state, where farming and ranching is a huge industry employing many people. And, of course, countless people rely on California farms and ranches for food. So the question is, how do you get younger people interested in farming? Farmers and ranchers are working on it. Just last week, there was a meeting in Winters with leaders from ag and government. Joining us are farmers from two generations. We have Michael O'Gorman, who's been an organic farmer for over 40 years, and he was one of the speakers at last week's meeting in Winters. And Hallie Mueller, who's a younger farmer and is outreach and education director at Full Belly Farm. Michael O'Gorman, Hallie Mueller, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Michael O'Gorman, how old were you when you became what you would call a farmer?
I was, 21, 22 years old, and was really just jumped into it and immediately knew that's what I wanted to do, and, fought real hard to keep getting to be able to do it.
And when you were that age, did you think then, did you imagine then that you'd still be farming decades later?
Actually, I imagined that I was going to try real hard to be able to be farming.
Yeah.
And there were several times where, and there was two times in my career early on where I went down and I had to dust myself off and pick myself up and said, I'm going in for another round and staying at it. So,
but it's going to be a tough job, at least sometimes of the year.
It's a tough job physically. It's tough mentally. It's tough financially. It's tough emotionally. I don't think people outside the industry realize that it's more than a job. It's a real life commitment, and it's real challenging. But it's also very, very rewarding.
Well, you said it's challenging. It's tough physically, mentally, emotionally, financially. That does beg the question: why do it?
Because the rewards of the fruits of your labor, the rewards of feeling good about being able to see what you produce, that you feed people, that you physically care for the land, that you're doing something tangible and something real, and it's extremely rewarding.
Why do you think the average age of farmers in California is rising? It's already 58 and heading north.
Well, the age all over the country, there's been a kind of a 40-year, in the lifespan of my career, the number of farmers in the country has gone from about 2.2 million to 960,000. That's someone who's primary income comes from farming, and our population has gone from 200 million to 310 million. So that's a real shrink in the number of people farming, and it's been a lot of consolidation of farmland. But everything that we see that's wrong in our food system is the monocropping, the overuse of pesticides, the shipping of food so far, and the containment feeding animal. Everything has to do with the lack of human capital investment in agriculture, and so we really want to see more people going into farming.
We're talking about an effort to encourage more younger people, as well as more people in general, to get into farming. Michael O'Gorman has been a farmer for many years, an organic farmer. Hallie Mueller, how old are you, Hallie?
I'm 25.
How long have you been in the farm business?
Well, I was actually lucky enough to be born on Full Belly Farm. We're a 300-acre organic fruits and vegetables farm up in the Cape Valley. And so I've been in farming for 25 years. I made the choice when I was done with college. I studied agriculture science and education to move back to my family's farm. And I'm there now, and I couldn't be happier.
Well, you knew when you were very young, probably, or at least got a hint of what O'Gorman was talking about, that it's physically, mentally, financially, emotionally tough to be a farmer. Why did you decide to stay in the family business?
It is all of those things that Michael said, but the rewards, again, I just want to reiterate, they're incredible. And I feel like what we're doing is real, and what we're able to produce on our farm, it's truly an honor to be a farmer. And I think growing food for people is there's nothing greater than doing that.
Okay, so you're sold on it, but why do you think there aren't enough other younger people who are sold on it?
I think people in my generation aren't as inclined to enjoy hard work.
And, oh my goodness!
there are a lot of young people who would like to become farmers, and who are really excited about farming and who are finding themselves really, really enjoying being on farms. But we just need to make maybe more opportunities for them to learn on farms and find ways to draw them to that.
So it's hard work, but is it also, do you think, the fact that farming just seems kind of remote from most people's life? Because most people live in towns or cities.
Absolutely, yeah. It's probably a throwback to generations that they're not even, sort of, they don't know anything about. So, but on our farm, for example, we have people who were sixth grade math teachers now learning how to farm, who were just involved in the tech industry, who studied neurology or, were Montessori school teachers that now want to become farmers because they were searching for something more. So it doesn't have to be someone who was born and raised on a farm to go back to a farm. What we're finding is that people who are generations removed from farming really wanting to go back.
But Michael O'Gorman, I can imagine there's also a tendency among people who don't live or work on farms to romanticize the farm life. Have you noticed that in people? And what do you say to someone who was born and raised in a city and says, I want to be a farmer?
My first question is, try it, do it. Don't put all your inheritance down on that piece of land until you've maybe worked a couple seasons and not only learned you really like being too tired to go out on the weekend and when Friday and Saturday night come and see if it's for you, but also to see what type of farming you like and to gain the knowledge. And so I really think that there's a lot of ways through working on farms like Full Belly or other parts of agriculture. California is a very employment-rich opportunity in agriculture, and so it's a great chance for someone to start that way. And we actually have a crisis for employees in agriculture as well.
You both work in organic farming. Is it easier or harder to persuade people from outside of farming to get involved if it's organic farming? I mean, on the one hand, there's a sort of a nice feel to organic farming. A lot of people are interested in eating that way. But is it also perhaps a little more complicated, a little harder than conventional farming?
So there are a lot of issues that surround agriculture and land. Being able to afford a farm is a huge one. And so in order to become, you have to find your market. And so I think a lot of young farmers are turning to organic agriculture because the market there is really rich. And in order to become a farmer, you need a lot of land, I guess, if you're a conventional farmer, and that's harder to come by unless you have a wealthy uncle or you're inheriting a farm. Yeah, and it's really hard to find that land. And so you need to be able to start probably smaller than that. And that's why a lot of young farmers tend to turn towards organic agriculture. It's a system that works, and it's a system that I think a lot of people are finding to be very successful.
Do you agree with Michael O'Gorman that regardless of one's financial situation, it probably makes sense to get a job on a farm for a while just to really dip your toe in the water?
Oh, gosh, yes. I think a lot of people think of farming in a very romantic sense. And so on our farm, we have an internship where you can work on our farm. It's a paid internship, and you're there and you really are learning. And I think you get that romantic sense of farming knocked out of you really quickly. And you realize how hard of work it is. It's exhausting physical labor. But at the end of the day, you know that you're doing something that's really real and really good.
Michael, when I was growing up in Scotland, I had some in-laws on my mother's side of the family who were farmers. And my memory of them is always they would walk into the house and they'd be saying, oh, my goodness, it's been a terrible harvest this year. I don't know how we're going to make it. I'm sure other people have heard farmers talk that way. What do you say to someone who worries about the financial solvency of farming?
What I say after 40 years of farming in my new life, my new career, I'm running a project that's helping young men and women coming out of the military get involved in agriculture. And what I tell them is, looking 40 years ahead in your lifespan, in the lifespan of your upcoming career, and our shrinking land base, our shrinking water base, increasing population, the value of food is really, really going to go up. If you can learn to farm, your biggest asset isn't going to be your land. Your biggest asset isn't going to be your business. It's going to be your knowledge. The knowledge to learn to farm and to grow food is going to be really valuable in your lifetime. So, farmers, we love to complain because we feel like we work harder than anyone so that we earn the right. So we're the biggest whiners on earth, but the and we kind of tolerate it in each other. But the reality is that it's a really, really good time to go into agriculture.
You mentioned your work with veterans. You're executive director of the Farmer Veteran Coalition. Are there any skills that you tend to see in veterans that would dispose them towards being farmers?
Well, one of the things that's really driven me to work with the veterans is that there is a lot of interest in people going into agriculture. And I'm really looking for who's going to be out there doing it 5 years and 10 years from now. So that's that sense of willingness to really take on something difficult and challenging and stay at it. I see a lot of the character qualities in the veterans that I think are going to really transfer into good careers in farming.
And Hallie Muller, the state and federal governments are interested in this issue. This meeting that was in Winters last week included Michael Gorman, but there were federal and state agriculture officials there to try and figure out ways to encourage younger generations to pursue farming and ranching. But Hallie, I think it's also fair to say that despite the large amounts of money that some farms and ranches get from the federal government, there's also a longstanding sort of independent-minded streak among farmers and ranchers. How do they feel about the government getting involved in this?
I think farmers across the nation would agree that we need more farmers. And so any support that we can get in training new farmers, creating training centers, supporting farms that have, hands-on internship programs, that's all very, very important. We need young people to see agriculture as a viable career option and not as something that's totally out of the realm of possibility.
Well, if you're either a younger person or you're a veteran or anyone who's interested in farming, I guess Michael and Hallie would be good people to reach. We'll make sure you can find them on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. In the meantime, Michael Gorman, Hallie Muller, thank you both so much for joining us on Insight.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, who's also a physician, on the impact war has on health. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Our show is online. Joining us with details is Insight's Jen Picard. Hi, Jen.
Hi, good morning. Well, later this week, we'll be speaking with a representative from Keep Your Home California, a state-run program that assists cash-strapped homeowners and helps them stay in their homes. The program is directed by the California Housing Finance Agency. Do you have any questions for Keep Your Home California? Have you or anyone you know used the program? And was it successful? You can let us know by commenting on our Facebook page, Insight at Capital Public Radio, or by sending us an email to insight@capradio.org. If you happen to have any comments or questions on anything you've heard on Insight, please don't hesitate to email us. That address again is insight@capradio.org. Or you can always go to our Facebook page, Insight on Capital Public Radio.
Thank you, Jen.
You're welcome.
A Nobel Peace Prize winner is in town. Dr. Victor Seidel is an expert on the impact of war on health, including public health. He was a joint winner of the Peace Prize in 1985 as a co-founder of the group International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Dr. Seidel was also one of the founders of the group Physicians for Social Responsibility, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. Victor Seidel is in Sacramento because last night he was a keynote speaker to the Sacramento chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He was talking about the health consequences of war. Right now he's in our studio. Dr. Victor Seidel, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much.
Well, what are the health impacts of war? Clearly, soldiers suffer health impact when they're injured or killed. What are the broader impacts?
The broader impacts are voluminous. If you begin to think about the impact of families of people who are killed in war or who are injured in war or have disabilities because of war, the impact on their families lasts much longer than any war. Also, the cost of war is an important part of the impact of war.
Well, you have worked for many years in public health. I know that today you're speaking to public health people at UC Davis. But public health physicians and workers can prepare for epidemics, all that sort of thing. They have some degree of control over how epidemics, for example, spread in the community, viruses, that sort of thing. But there's not a whole lot that a public health doctor can do to prevent wars. How do you handle that?
Let me disagree with you. There's a great deal public health doctors can do with regard to wars. Physicians for Social Responsibility was built by both medical doctors, people treating patients, and public health doctors. And together we have found a way to bring doctors together to try to prevent war. We worked on the Vietnam War. We've worked on the Afghanistan War. We've worked on the Iraq War. All of these are killing wars. They destroy families. They destroy people. These should not be permitted.
You were one of the founders of Physicians for Social Responsibility in 1961. The title Physicians for Social Responsibility implies a broad scope.
Correct.
But we're talking here about war. How important was war or trying to prevent war in the founding of Physicians for Social Responsibility?
It was the key for starting point. When we talked about a single issue organization, which is where PSR began, we started with nuclear war, started with thermonuclear war, and the incredible destruction that a bomb, hundreds of times greater, 1,000 times greater than the bombs used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki would cause. And that was the way PSR started. We went on to talk about the cost of the arms race. We went on to talk about the ways in which there are other things that could be prevented but cannot be treated by physicians. This is part of public health. It's part of clinical medicine.
There have been many wars since 1961, not just not involving the U.S., but involving the U.S., and the U.S. is still at war. Can you point to successes of Physicians for Social Responsibility in preventing war?
Well, let's start with a rather simple illustration. We help collect children's deciduous teeth, baby teeth, which showed the strontium, radioactive strontium in the teeth, replacing the calcium.
That was presumably fallout from bombs?
Exactly. And if the bomb testing had not been taking place in the atmosphere, those teeth, the calcium, the strontium in the teeth, would not have been present. We worked with President Kennedy to develop a international convention called the Partial Test Ban Convention, which prevented the continued use of nuclear explosions in the atmosphere. This is simply one example of the kinds of things that physicians and public healthers can do.
Back in the 60s, there was widespread concern about the possibility of nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union at that time. How would you evaluate the mood of the people today? It doesn't seem to me that the fear of nuclear war is on the top of people's minds the way it was in the past.
Now that's true, but one needs to think, for example, of the fact that both India and Pakistan are nuclear powers. Even a small nuclear war, recently PSR's work has demonstrated, Dr. Ira Halfand was the one who worked on these. This was evidence that even a small nuclear war, explosion of a few nuclear bombs, would cause global cooling. We're concerned about global warming, but global cooling could prevent the sun rays from getting to the earth, could cause us famine, all of this has been demonstrated in articles, and this kind of episode is a continued problem for nuclear war.
My guest is Dr. Victor Seidel. He's a Nobel Peace Prize winner through his co-founding of the group International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. He's also one of the co-founders of Physicians for Social Responsibility in 1961. So PSR is celebrating its 50th anniversary. And he's in town because he gave a speech last night to the Sacramento chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. Let's talk for a minute about Iran, which has started up a nuclear program. The U.S. and its allies believe that Iran is working to create nuclear weapons, but Iran denies that. What advice would you give to President Obama and others, and for that matter, Iran, on how to handle this?
Well, with regard to Iran, Iran has to be very clear that it is not developing nuclear weapons, that it has perfect right to develop nuclear power. We feel that's a dangerous track also, but if they're working to develop fissile material to develop nuclear power, that's all right. That's a part of acceptable behavior. And the United States has got to learn that everybody that is working on nuclear power, everyone who is working on fissile materials, isn't necessarily a bomb maker. And in order to begin to think about that, we can't fall into the trap that we fell into in beginning the Iraq War, the invasion of Iraq, because we feared that there were nuclear weapons in Iraq. There weren't. It was proven. And now we are talking about nuclear weapons in Iran.
What if it turned out that there were evidence that Iran was trying to create nuclear weapons and there was proof that they were at an advanced stage? There's no public discussion of this, but it's pretty well known that both the U.S. and Israel have at least considered dropping bombs on those facilities to take them out. Do you think that would make sense as a preemptive strike to try and allegedly prevent a nuclear attack from Iran?
That would be the same kind of mistake that was made in Iraq and that's being made now and continuing in Afghanistan. The mistake is trying to deal with terrorism by declaring war on terrorism. Terrorism cannot be defeated by war. Terrorism has to be defeated by talking about the ways in which the world can be made better. PSR works on that.
You co-founded Physicians for Social Responsibility 50 years ago. You co-founded International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War 30 years ago. How do you feel today about the state of the world when it comes to war, the threat of war and nuclear war? Do you feel more or less hopeful than then?
I am just as hopeful because I see the number of people who are working on this problem, people trying to find ways of solving the problem, people trying to find ways of convincing people that war is not the way. And we believe because physicians, public healthers throughout the world are now working on this, I'm quite hopeful.
Dr. Victor Seidel, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I know you have a busy day today. You've got a couple of public events at UC Davis School of Public Health and the UC Davis Medical Center later on today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, how to garden, cook, and heal using native plants of the Sierra Nevada. You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. What's in the news today? Joining us with details is Joe Barr, Capital Public Radio's news director. He's in the newsroom. Joe, what's in the news?
Hey, good morning, Jeffrey. Well, Governor Jerry Brown has less than a week to sign or veto many bills that are still left on his desk. And he said at the outset that he was going to veto a lot of bills. So we wondered, has he lived up to his word? We're going to have a story this afternoon looking at whether the governor has vetoed a lot of bills. And the early indications are he may not have vetoed as many as we would have expected given his early proclamations. Ben Adler's going to have something on that for us. Well, these are good times for the California lottery. In depressed times for everyone else, the lottery is doing quite well. State lottery sales were up 13% in the last fiscal year. And lottery officials are just about to unveil a brand new game. It's a $10 scratcher ticket that gives players a chance to win $1 million instantly. And lottery officials are hoping that it's going to push business into record territory. We'll have a story on that this afternoon from Jenny O'Mara. And then as a preview for later this week, of course, the countdown is on to the opening of the new terminal at the Sacramento International Airport. It's going to be opening on Thursday. And Capital Public Radio is going to have a lot of coverage in the coming days on our news programs and on Insight. And Jeffrey, you were out there just the other day and got
a preview
of it.
Yeah, we taped a segment out there. It's an amazing place, and I'm looking forward to hearing the segment a little later this week.
Yeah, it's quite an extraordinary facility, and we're going to have coverage on Insight, on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and online. We'll have lots of multimedia material, including video tours and graphics and all kinds of great things as the new terminal is about to open. So we'll have that story coming up this week. And the other ones that I talked about on Governor Brown's vetoes and the new lottery scratcher game, those are coming up this afternoon on All Things Considered.
Joe Barr, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Earlier this morning in Insight, we talked about farming. Before farming, we all got a lot of our food from gathering, and that's the spirit behind Living Wild, a new book about gardening, cooking, and healing with native plants of the Sierra Nevada. The authors are two Nevada County women. They collaborated on the book with a variety of experts. One of those authors and one of those collaborators join us. The co-author is Alicia Funk, and the collaborator is Farrell Cunningham. We'll start with Alicia Funk. Alicia, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Glad to be here.
Where do you get your plants that you cook with and heal with? Do you buy them? Do you grow them? Do you forage?
Well, I really encourage planting them in the landscape. So right around my house, I grow most of the plants that I end up using for food and for health.
And why do you encourage growing as opposed to buying or foraging?
Well, first of all, buying is not an option for most of these plants because they're not commercially available in the grocery store, at least not yet. So, but foraging, there's some concerns around foraging and just in the sense that you don't want to endanger any populations of native plants when in your quest to gather the latest exotic food. So,
because you might trample over some animal or insect or plants as you make your way towards those tasty blackberries.
Exactly.
Yes. You use plants, native plants, for cooking and for healing. How did you get started in this? Was it cooking or healing?
Well, primarily from the food sense, and I really became interested in using Sierra Nevada native plants for food and health, really while spending time outdoors with my family and looking for simple ways for us to live more sustainably.
Yeah. You said earlier that buying a lot of these plants isn't even an option because many of them are not commercially available, or at least not easily commercially available. Give us an example of one of those plants.
Well, acorns is a good example. It's an abundant food source that's been used by our local indigenous people for many years. And it's a food source that's used actually around the world. However, it's not commercially available, in your local bakery at this point as far as, but it is a wonderful food source. So I love to make acorn bread. And by the way, I have renamed acorns oak nuts, and I've done that because I've rebranded the acorn. Anytime when I'm teaching a class and people hear the word acorn, they tend to think squirrel, and they don't tend to think of a gourmet food item. So by calling it the nut of the oak tree, which is truly what it is, it makes it more appealing.
Yeah, because I guess some people might think of the acorn as being squirrel food, whereas an oak nut is something we can eat.
Exactly, exactly.
My guest is Alicia Funk. She's a founder of the Living Wild Project and a co-author of the book Living Wild, Gardening, Cooking, and Healing with Native Plants of the Sierra Nevada. Now, one of the collaborators on the book was Farrell Cunningham, who's a member of the Mountain Maidu tribe. He provided traditional recipes and Maidu plant names and uses to the book. He's also a former guest on Insight. Farrell Cunningham, welcome back to our show.
Good morning.
Give us an example of one of the Maidu plant names that you contributed.
Oh, well, I'm looking at the book right now. Polom Tom.
Okay.
So Polom Tom is the Maidu word for buckeye.
Say that again, please.
Polom Tom.
Let me see if I can find that in the, no, I'm not finding it, but,
on page 111.
Page 111. Okay. Well, since I have the book right here, what kind of plant is that?
It's a small tree, a buckeye tree.
The small buckeye tree.
Yeah. California buckeye.
And, the word, the Maidu word that you used, is that the word that you use, in daily life?
Either polom tam or there's another there, sawom tam.
And why are there different words?
They just indicate different uses for the plant.
Yes.
For example, sawom tam is for fire drills.
Yes.
That sort of thing, being the root being sa, which means fire. Polo is a reference to water.
You also provided some traditional recipes. Give us an example of one of those.
Well, I didn't provide much.
The manzanita cider.
Ah,
yes.
But the manzanita cider is a wonderful recipe. Manzanita is a plant that's really in abundance in our local landscape.
Sure is.
It's a good one to know how to use. Farrell shared his recipe, which is in the book, which is on making a manzanita cider, which is delicious. And also, it turns out we sent the manzanita berries off to the lab because we were curious as far as what are the health benefits of some of these native foods. And it turns out that manzanita berries, along with our abundant elderberry and madrone berries, turn out to be three times higher than in antioxidants than even blueberries and pomegranates.
Farrell, I'm looking at the manzanita cider recipe on page 66. Can you describe the taste of the manzanita cider?
It's something like apple juice. And maybe a little more citrusy.
Yes. It says here, collect the berries in summer. Do you need to collect a lot when you're making, let's say, a bottle of cider?
No, I wouldn't say you need a lot, a cup or two for a bottle.
Yes. And then is it a lot of work to actually make the cider?
No, not at all.
No. Okay.
It's a relatively simple process.
It's wonderful because it's something that doesn't require any cooking at all, because you're just pouring the water over the berries. And it also, you can use the berries first if you grind the berries, the manzanita berries, if you just lightly grind them and press them through a mesh strainer, you create manzanita sugar. And then with the remainder of the seeds and the skins and things, you can use that to also make the cider from. So you can create sugar and cider out of our abundant manzanita.
Well, Alicia, do you grow manzanita on your property? And if not, do you feel okay about just harvesting some of the berries from manzanita just as you see them beside the road?
Yes, I wouldn't encourage anyone to gather anything right next to a road due to traffic, and you don't want a lot of car exhaust on your dinner.
Sure.
Manzanita is really in abundance in our local landscape, so planting it is not typically necessary, although there are quite a few different varieties of manzanita, and they all have an edible berry, and you can process them a similar way.
Alicia, does it take a lot of your time to grow the plants that you use for cooking and for healing and to find out how to make good use of them, that sort of thing? How does that compare with if you just went down to the local store and bought what you needed there for cooking and for medicine?
Right. Well, it's not, I won't fool you. I will say it's not quite as convenient as going to the local grocery store. But I do believe strongly that it is worth taking the time to grow and harvest your own native food and medicine. Besides just the fun of being outdoors, I mean, many of us have lost our real daily connection to the natural world. Even though we might consider ourselves environmentalists, we're spending more time staring at screens than we are walking through the woods. So I think it's a good, healthy activity, and it's definitely worth the time to be outside in nature.
Your book is Living Wild. It's about plants. Where do you stand on meat and dairy products?
Well, I don't really have any recipes in there on the meat aspect. My family does put together, we do a wild Thanksgiving feast every year where we try to do as much of the food, make it from our local landscape. So we do include in that wild salmon, which was traditionally, it is traditional to the upper Yuba River watershed where we live, and we're attempting to bring it back to this landscape. So I do extend my native plant wild Thanksgiving to include wild salmon.
Well, Farrell, I guess salmon, locally caught salmon, was traditionally part of the Maidu diet.
Absolutely, a major part of the diet.
Yes. So what do you think the prospects are for that coming back?
Well, I think they're pretty good. I'm always trying to remain positive about that, and there's a good chance of it happening, maybe not soon, but hopefully sooner than later. Yes. While we still have the opportunity, while there's still some salmon that are interested in coming up this river.
Yes.
We are having, I know the Chiaki Maidu tribe is having a calling back the salmon ceremony, in fact, this very Saturday at Sycamore Ranch, just outside of Marysville.
Alicia, you sent me earlier some information about this wild Thanksgiving feast that you've just been talking about, and you included some ideas for desserts, including oak nut bliss bars. I guess those are the acorns, the renamed acorns.
Yes, those are the desserts. Tend to be my favorite way to introduce people to native foods. Everyone loves desserts, so it's a pretty easy to get people to try a new dessert. Desserts that we typically will have for Thanksgiving, Douglas fir tip sorbet. So the Douglas fir is high in vitamin C, and
it smells good.
Yes, it smells good, and you can even add the tips to your water bottle when you're hiking. They turn bright green in spring, or make a tea out of it. But we like to make sorbet and enjoy it as dessert. The bliss bars, the oak nut bliss bars, are use the acorn flour as the primary flour. And acorns are a gluten-free flour, so it's a nice one to add in for people that are sensitive to gluten.
And manzanita berry ice cream.
Yes, that's a new release this year. every year we try to challenge ourselves to try something new, and I'm working with a local ice cream maker, Treats, here in Nevada City to develop a new manzanita berry ice cream for us to include this year.
And I'm curious, what does oak nut, a.k.a. acorn, taste like as an ingredient?
Well, I've given it, I try to challenge our local chefs as well to come up with new recipes using the acorns. So, again, people stop thinking of this as just a survival food, but really start to become curious again about what these taste like. And it's got a rich, nutty flavor. It's really delicious, and everyone that I've given this to has really enjoyed baking with it. So,
In addition to being without gluten, it's got some nutrients in it.
Yes, it does. It has it's higher in omega-6, vitamin A, folate, and potassium than whole grain flour, and again without having the gluten.
Well, I'm feeling pretty hungry now.
I should be down there feeding you some oak nut marzipan right now.
Yes, I would happily eat it. I like marzipan. Well, thank you so much. Alicia Funk is co-author of the book Living Wild. It's subtitled Gardening, Cooking, and Healing with Native Plants of the Sierra Nevada. She co-wrote it with Karen Kaufman. Also joining us was Farrell Cunningham, who's a member of the Mountain Maidu tribe. He contributed to the book along with other people. Alicia, Farrell, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. And we will be doing a taste of our landscape at the Roseville Maidu Museum on November 19th, if anyone wants to try some of these wild foods.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, we remember Wangari Maathai, advocate for the environment and women's rights, and the first woman from Africa to win the Nobel Peace Prize. She died last week. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Here's your weather. There's a storm building with a chance of showers later today in the Central Valley and snow in the mountains, but don't let that keep you from the biggest little cat house and dogs too. It's a pet adoption promotion this month in Northern Nevada. All this month, you can adopt a special partner at the price you choose. Visit the Nevada Humane Society shelter in Reno. For something indoors, if it's a little wet outside tonight in Stockton, check out the musical Bye Bye Birdie, presented by Lincoln High School. It starts at 7. There's a 20% chance of rain this afternoon, as I said. Today's high in Sacramento, 71. 71 also in Stockton, 70 in Reno, 66 in Nevada City, where we're gathering acorns, and 72 degrees in Quincy. On tomorrow's Insight, we'll bring you The Spokes, an all-woman a cappella group from UC Davis. But now, we'll remember a distinguished former guest on Insight who died last week. She's Wangari Maathai, an environmentalist from Kenya, best known for her Greenbelt movement, which planted tens of millions of trees in her homeland. She was also a leader in women's issues and a member of Kenya's parliament. In 2004, she was the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. And in 2007, she visited Sacramento to give a speech. She was on Insight at that time when she joined us. I asked Wangari Maathai what brought her into politics and political work.
It was almost an accident that I ended up in politics, really, because as you read the book, you realize that after that early experience in my village, I ended up in Atchison, Kansas, in the 60s, and it was partly due to an initiative that was introduced by Senator John Kennedy, who later on became the President of the United States. And then I went back home, and all I wanted was to become a lecturer at the University of Nairobi, which I joined in 1966. And it was while I was there that I started experiencing injustices that are meted against women at that time, where I was being treated not as a full lecturer, yet I was fully qualified and I was doing a very good job and I was working very hard, but I was getting less than my male colleagues. And that perplexed me. And especially having been to America, where I had tasted the freedom and the desire to achieve and the desire to experience full potential, I started agitating so that women in the University of Nairobi would have the same terms of service as men. And that was the beginning of my questioning inequities, questioning corruption, questioning the unwillingness of society to treat everybody as equal. And that eventually is what led me into politics, because it all has to do with the political decisions.
What kind of opposition did you meet when you decided to be an active politician?
Initially, it was not understood as activism that would threaten the authorities. I think that it was not until I started organizing women to plant trees that the authorities realized that what I was doing was potentially dangerous to them, because I was organizing, I was mobilizing, and I was also educating, empowering people and encouraging them to question when there are injustices, when human rights are not respected, when the rule of law is not respected, when people are corrupt, when people misuse the power that they have, that's when they considered me a threat.
What gave you the idea, the specific idea, to start planting trees?
The idea comes from the fact that in the mid-1970s, in precisely 1975, there was going to be the very first United Nations Conference on Women, and it was going to be in Mexico. And women all over the world were encouraged to discuss the issues that they would raise in Mexico. And so in Kenya, we did that under the auspices of the National Council of Women of Kenya. And while I went there to take my problems from the university, such as the discrimination of women in the university, when I went there, I started listening to the women from the rural areas. And I realized that some of these women came from the same areas where I grew up, and which I described in the book, and which is very beautiful. And it was quite clear that something drastic had taken place in that area, and the environment had become degraded. The women were saying they needed clean drinking water. Yet I remember as a child going to the river and drinking water from the river and bringing water to the household and drinking without even thinking of boiling it. They also wanted firewood. And I remember there being a lot of woodlots and me collecting firewood from these woodlots. And they needed food, nutritious food. Well, I remember that we had a lot of food. So by listening to these rural women, and perhaps because I had an education in biology, I was very quickly able to make the link between the problems that the women were describing and made them, and I understood that these problems were actually symptoms of an environment that has become degraded. Mm-hmm. And so I told the women, let us plant trees. I never went to Mexico myself, but I immediately started what I thought would be a short-term project to plant trees with these women.
My guest is Wangari Maathai. She wrote Unbowed, a memoir of her life and work as an environmental leader in her homeland of Kenya. She won the 2004 Nobel Peace Prize in large part because of her work with the Green Belt Movement, which she founded. It's a network of women who've planted 40 million trees across the country. Have those 40 million trees replaced what was lost?
Well, you know, we need to plant many more millions of trees because, unfortunately, a large portion of the people we are working with are poor people, they are rural people, and their main source of energy is wood. And so even as they are planting, they are also using these trees for to meet some felt needs, such as the need for firewood, for fencing, for building their houses, for fodder for their animals. And so the competition for wood is still very high. But the important thing is to be able to explain to the women and to the society in general that trees are extremely important in our environment and that we need to plant them faster than we are cutting them.
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Wangari Maathai.
Thank you.
And that was the late Wangari Maathai. She died last week in Kenya, age 71. We spoke with her on Insight in 2007. That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers, Liz Cazares and Lynn Weaver. The assistant producer of Insight is James Morrison. The technical director, Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. We'll be back tomorrow. At Insight, we have one goal.
It's appropriate that I provide an insight.
That's a tough question.
You know what you're talking about.
To get the answers you want to hear.
Well, that's true.
With Insight.
From interesting people of every stripe.
We're here with Jeffrey Kallison.
You have done your homework, Jeffrey.
Interesting question.
Oh, you hit it right on the head, Jeff.
Yes.
I like your accent, by the way.
I'm Jeffrey Kallison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.